go ahead.
And I'm the captain of the Mandarin advanced.
All right. Okay, so this is a two-part talk. One part is about accountability, that is how you stop all these bad things we've been hearing about, and the other part is about how you can still have fun after you've been very conservative and stopped everything. So a little bit of introduction. Much of this is stuff that you've probably already heard, but it's good to get us all on roughly the same footing. This is probably the most important piece of the introduction. Most people think that real-world security is about locks, and that's completely untrue. Real-world security is not mostly about locks. It's mostly about punishment. The reason your house does not get broken into is not because the burglar cannot get through the lock on the front door or find some other way into your house. The reason your house doesn't get broken into is because, although the likelihood of the burglar being caught and sent to jail is not very high, it's high enough to make the thing unattractive. And if that stops being true, then your house does get broken into. This is pretty fundamental. If you try to enforce security in the real world with locks, it's very, very costly. You can see that from the relatively small number of places, mainly in the national security environment, where people actually do that. It's very expensive and very inconvenient. It's not what we do in real life. So what security is about is risk management. The cost has to be kept less than the expected loss, because perfect security is a chimera. You can't have it at any reasonable price. The locks have to be good enough to keep the bad guys from breaking in too often. The most important thing is they have to get caught and punished often enough that they're effectively deterred. And another important component, which I'm not going to talk about, is being able to recover from any damage that occurs at a reasonable cost.
But just, I don't know why it occurs to me, but you know, if you think about car thefts, I'm not sure this applies, for example. I mean, I don't have statistics, but there's a huge number of car thefts. Most people, you know, many of them never get punished. Filling the Boston area or other.
Yeah, well, it's probably less likely the car theft is going to be punished, and that's one of the reasons that you have a lot more of them.
Right.
But in both cases, the locks are pretty ineffective.
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm not trying to say that punishment is always effective. When it isn't, you have to expect to have problems.
Yeah, seems entirely consistent.
Right. Situation on the internet is basically the same, but the difficulty we have is that there's not much accountability on the internet. You can't find the bad guys. If you can't find them, you're not going to be able to punish them. This is pretty serious. So it's good to review what are the causes of security problems. There's two classes, broad classes of causes of security problems. One is exploitable bugs, right? Microsoft ships a browser with a bug in it. The right piece of HTML will allow the bad guy to take over the machine. The other cause of security problems, which in some sense I think is more fundamental, is bad configuration. Now, there's this old idea of the trusted computing base. People used to say it's the hardware and software that the security of your system depends on. You try to keep it small. They tended to overlook the fact that it's not the trusted computing base does not only consist of hardware and software, it also consists of configuration information. A modern machine has a lot of configuration information. It's far more dangerous than the hardware or the software because those things get built once or a few times, typically by professionals. The configuration information gets built over again every time you install a system. And typically it's built by people who are not professionals, and even if they are, they're not primarily interested in security. So this is a really serious problem, and the biggest and most interesting class of issues in security have to do with how can we bring this configuration problem under control by drastically reducing the amount of configuration and making it much more intelligible to the users. And this is why, in my view, least privilege, which has been the mantra of the security community for 40 years, doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's too hard to configure. And it turns out, actually, there might be a way around this. There's a thing called role-based access control, which probably has not been discussed in this course. And I used to think it was it's quite popular in some communities. I used to think it was completely bogus, because I used to think, well, a role is nothing more nor less than a group, and we already have groups, so why do we need a new name for that? But it turns out there's a little bit more to it than that. At least I think this is true. Depending on who you talk to, you can get very different stories about what role-based access control is. But this is the story that I tell this month. There's two aspects to it, actually. You've got these roles, which are groups. But the other thing about role-based access control is the ACLs are immutable. The only thing the administrator can do, the ACLs are constructed by the programmer. The only thing the administrator can do is populate the roles. And that's a huge plus, because it drastically reduces the amount of configuration, because the ACLs now are no longer configuration. They're part of the program. That's got to be much better. But anyway, this is not really relevant to what the talk is about. it's good to bear this picture in mind. This is the canonical security picture, the access control model picture. You have an isolation. You've got principals that are issuing requests. They go through some kind of reference monitor that decides whether the request is good or not. The reference monitor is driven by policy. If the reference monitor says yes, the object gets the request and it does whatever it's supposed to do, and you run an audit log. And you put the whole thing in this blue box, which isolates it from the rest of the world. And what isolate means is that the only way it's going to interact with the rest of the world is through this reference monitor, this guarded channel. Does this actually light up? No. That's frustrating. So how does security work? How do you do access control? Well, it basically has three parts. There's authentication. If you're going to follow this guard model, you have to know who made the request. That's what authentication does. Principals, the answer to who made the request is a thing called a principals. Principals are mainly people, but they could also be channels, servers, programs, lots of different things. Once you've figured out who made the request, you have to figure out whether or not it should be granted, who's going to be trusted with this resource. That's called authorization. Typically, in order to make authorization at all manageable, you have to group both the principals and the resources, so there's not too many different things you have to say. The old-fashioned idea that every file has an ACL is just nuts. You can't possibly administer that. You don't want to spend your entire time looking at ACLs, and you've got hundreds of thousands of files. And then the third element is audit, which answers the question, who did what to the system when? Locking basically consists of authentication plus authorization. Deterrence consists of authentication plus auditing. And all these things, these three things all start with AU, so they are the gold standard for security. Okay. It makes it easy to remember. Okay, so much for preliminaries. In order for this whole story to work, the isolation has to work. It doesn't make any sense to say that the security is going to be enforced by having guards on access to resources if you can just bypass the guard. Oh, something I forgot to say about isolation. What does it mean to be isolated? Well, I've told you one story, namely all the requests coming through this channel, but here's a more abstract version of what it means to be isolated. It means I'm isolated if anything that goes wrong is my fault. That is, I had a chance to look at the input and I decided to let it through. Right? If the stuff came in some other way that I didn't have control over, then I wasn't isolated. Okay, so isolation is imperfect. The old idea was we're going to make the isolation perfect. We're going to have this trusted computing base. It's not going to have any bugs. It's going to be small, simple, straightforward. We're going to understand it completely. And the security is only going to depend on the trusted computing base. Well, we've been trying to do this for 40 years, and it's been a complete bust. The problem is worse than it's gotten worse every year for the last 40 years, and it's continuing to get worse. And there's fundamental reasons for that. People don't care about security, right? They want features. They want to ship their products. They don't care about security. Forget that. So the trusted computing base today is 10 to 50 million lines of code, depending on what system you're running. And it's growing. And no amount of exhortation and hand-wringing is going to change that. So how can we possibly make isolation work when we have these 50 million lines of code full of bugs? Well, the answer's got to be, the only answer I can think of is, since we're not going to be able to get rid of the bugs, I mean, you know, Microsoft and other reputable suppliers try hard to get the bugs out of their software, but there's just no way you're going to get all the bugs or even all the security-relevant bugs out of 50 million lines of code. After we've done the best we can, there's going to be tens of thousands of bugs left. There's no way around it. So what's the alternative? The answer I give is if the bug's going to be there, you better not tickle it. All right. So how could you possibly avoid tickling the bugs? Typically, you know, the bugs are not the security... Relevant bugs are not things that happen routinely. They have to be tickled by some bad guy who's trying to steer the system down that path. So if you don't talk to the bad guy, then he won't be able to do that. So how do you avoid tickling the bugs? Reject bad inputs. So what are them? What kind of inputs are there? Well, there's code, right? You shouldn't run code that might be bad. Or if you do, you should run it in some severely restricted way so that you think it's much less likely that it'll have a chance to tickle bugs. Communication. You should either reject communication with bad guys or you should severely restrict it. And that especially applies to websites since the communication of the website is so rich because of HTML and JavaScript and all those other things. Data. You shouldn't send data to bad guys. You shouldn't accept data from bad guys, especially not if it's complex. Right? Vanilla ASCII with no Unicode in it is probably okay. We know that JPEG is a little bit dangerous. Certainly HTML is extremely dangerous. Yes.
Two comments on this. How do you tell the difference between code and data?
We're going to get to some of these questions later.
Okay. And the second thing is, surely you can't just wall yourself off from the rest of the world.
No, no, and we're definitely going to get to that one later.
Okay. Yeah,
that's very important. So first, we're going to discuss the question of how does... What could be the mechanics of only accepting good inputs? And then we'll discuss the question of how you get out of that straitjacket. Okay? So, what's the meaning of bad? My definition is bad means unaccountable. Remember the original problem. You can't identify the bad guys, so you can't deter them. So the fix has got to be end nodes are going to enforce accountability, not the network. The network is not going to enforce accountability. There's a million reasons why that won't work. End nodes are going to enforce it. I am going to enforce accountability for the inputs that I get. How am I going to do that? I'm going to refuse inputs that aren't accountable enough. It's really simple. What does it mean for input to be accountable? What it means is that you can punish the sender.
Right, you go self-item now.
Right? It doesn't mean that there's a guarantee that the input is not going to cause trouble. What it means is that there's a reasonable chance of punishing the guy that sent it to you. So my view is this is an instance of one of the fundamental, there are two fundamental axioms of security. One is the best is the enemy of the good, and the other is all trust is local. Right? End nodes have to make their own decisions. Microsoft is not going to solve your problem. The U.S. Congress is not going to solve your problem. You're going to have to solve it yourself. We can help, but those decisions are for you to make. So for this to work, what do you have to have? You need an ecosystem which makes it possible for senders to become accountable and for receivers to demand accountability. And that's not good enough to have exhortation, right? That would be actual things that you can do. And then in order to make that work, you're almost certainly going to need third-party intermediaries most of the time, because the world is complex.
I think one thing to add is, yes, if you want to make this work, you also need to have some method of enforcing accountability.
No, that's the end node's job. The end node has got to demand accountability. There is not going to be any magic enforcement mechanism in the sky.
I'm talking more about a legal framework.
We'll talk about that in a minute. One possible form of accountability is legal, but it's not the only one by any means. And I think that's really important. If you insist that you only have accountability when you can send the bad guy to jail, that's going to be much too strong in my view. And we'll give some examples of that later. And if you want to make, you might say, well, what about distributed denial of service attacks? That's much more difficult because now the end node is not in control. So if you're going to make this idea work for DDoS, the ISPs are going to have to play too. And that's much harder, and I'm not going to talk about that. There's a few ideas about that, but basically I don't have a lot of confidence that problem can be attacked, whereas I do have confidence that this problem, the rest of the problem, can be attacked. Okay, so what does it mean for accountability to work? Senders have to be able to make themselves accountable. That means, since what it means to be accountable is that you can be punished, that means that you have to play, as a sender, you have to be prepared to pledge something that's of value to you. So, one example of something that's of value to you is friendship, right? If Ed decides that I'm a reliable sender, fundamentally his basis for deciding that I'm a reliable sender is that we know each other, and if I turn out to be a bad guy, he's going to cut me off. And that's a significant disincentive. Another possibility is reputation. If I'm on eBay, where there's a well-established reputation system, the reputation is of value to sellers. They don't want to lose it. There are various mechanisms by which they can lose it. That's another form of accountability. Money is another possibility, and that can take a variety of forms, too. For example, you want to get rid of spam? Here's a simple strategy for getting rid of spam. If I could configure my email client so that when a message comes in, it's going to go in the junk mail folder unless it has one of the following two properties. Property A, it's on some whitelist of senders. And we can argue about how well authenticated they have to be and all that. Property B, it comes with a link certified by some appropriate authority like Hotmail or Yahoo or AOL or somebody that I have confidence in, which has the property that if I click on the link, the sender has to contribute $1 to the Salvation Army. Okay? That is a form of accountability which, in my view, would get rid of spam. Completely. Right? Think about it.
Father?
I think if I were a hostile person, I would set up a botnet. Uh-huh. Have it email me lots of messages.
Well, botnets are a very interesting problem for this whole accountability game, and I don't really know what I think about it. There's a couple of different ways of looking at it. Dave Carger, for example, says botnets are not going to be a long-term problem here for the following reason, he says. Today, there's no real incentive for me to work to keep my machine from being a bot. Because, most bots are relatively well-behaved. They don't really do me any harm. Okay? But in the future with accountability, there is going to be incentive, because if a bot takes over my machine, it's going to be me, and then a lot of people are going to be mad at me, and I'm going to get punished, and I'm going to have a big incentive not to be a bot. And that, he says that's going to solve the problem. I don't know whether I believe that or not.
So the tricky thing with this is somebody accepting a message from you has to have a good sense of the risk involved, the risk reward. Even if you pledge $1 to the Salvation Army,
yes.
I got to figure out whether the worst thing that could happen to me will cost me more than $1.
Absolutely.
I don't believe people are capable of making that risk assessment.
Well, there's two separate issues with spam. Right? One is whether the spam can hurt you, and the other is whether it just gets in your way.
Fair enough.
So I was focused on the second. The first we'll talk about in a bit.
Great. I would just generate 9 billion messages from Butler.
How are you going to do that?
With a bot.
You're going to take over my machine.
Yeah. I just send out 1,000 messages from you. And
bots are a problem with the whole accountability story. I don't think it's going to be a killer problem, but it is the biggest problem with the whole accountability story. No question about it.
Stefan or Jeff, did you have a question or not?
Steve's question was mine.
So senders have to be able to make themselves accountable, and receivers have to be able to check accountability. That means the receiver has to be able to specify what constitutes being accountable enough, and that's not something that's going to be the same for all receivers. Different people are going to feel very differently about that, and receivers are going to have to be able to verify the sender's evidence of accountability in some very convenient way. I'm not telling you how to do all these things. These are problems that have to be worked on. What's the relationship between accountability and access control? Well, in principle, there's no difference, because accountability is a form of saying, I look at the input, it passes by a guard, and I try to decide whether I should accept it or not. But I think in practice, there's a huge difference. Access control is about locks. Accountability is about punishment. So for accountability, auditing is critical, but granularity is not. You can afford to be pretty sloppy. The game is not to guarantee that nothing bad will ever happen, but to make the whole enterprise of doing bad things not cost-effective. So the philosophy is very, very different, I think. What are you going to need in an accountability ecosystem? Well, I think you're going to need identity, reputation, and indirection services as part of people being able to establish accountability, because some of it can be established just by peer-to-peer relationships, but most of it can't work that way. You're going to need mechanisms for establishing trust relationships, both person-to-person and person-to-organization. You're going to need a flexible and simple user model for how users are supposed to understand what identity means. We're probably going to, for many aspects of accountability, we're going to need better user authentication than we have now. You know, smart cards, cell phones, biometrics, various ways that make it much more difficult to hijack someone's identity. And we're going to need some notion of application identity, almost certainly. Maybe we'll skip this one. Okay, so what's wrong with the whole accountability story? It's in conflict with freedom, right? We like to play on the web. That means going to lots of places that don't meet these stringent standards for accountability. If I take a view that I'm going to keep valuable stuff on my computer and I don't want it screwed up by bad inputs that might be coming in, that's going to stop me from visiting game sites and looking at porn and doing all kinds of other things that normal, healthy people want to do. So that's not acceptable. How are we going to reconcile these conflicting demands for accountability and freedom? Well, I have a very simple story for that. We're going to partition the world into two parts. There's going to be a green part, which is safer and more accountable, and we're going to have a red part, which is less safe and less accountable. That's pretty simple. By the way, this business of red and green perfectly illustrates one of the problems with trying to do anything about security. About 15% of the security people you tell this story to said, oh, you've got red and green backwards.
Right.
Obviously, the green guy should be the dangerous guy, and the red guy should be the safe guy. I find this completely incomprehensible, but there are people who sincerely believe it, or at least they pretend to.
They're colorblind.
No.
Red and black. Right. I mean, it comes from the crypto.
Oh,
yeah, that's
red. You think that's all those people are coming from there?
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
It's a red and black.
Okay, well, that could be. I can never remember which is red and which is black for crypto, so it's not a problem for me. So, what would it take to make this work? Well, I think there's two aspects to it. One is the user experience aspect. How does the user sort out what's red and what's green? And the other, which I think is pretty much orthogonal, is the isolation mechanism. The idea here is we're going to have these two worlds. They have to be kept pretty isolated from each other. How are we going to implement that? Well, you know, a really simple way to implement that is have two computers and air gap them. Then they'll definitely be isolated. Or, you know, connect them up with a network and be very cautious about what you allow to pass over the network. That's a less stringent form of isolation. Still less stringent is to run two VMs. Still less stringent than that is to run two processes or two sets of processes inside an OS. My personal opinion is that that won't work, because the way OSs have evolved over the last 20 or 30 years, there are so many communication paths between processes that it's very, very hard to block them all. But I could be wrong about that. And I don't propose to talk much about the isolation aspects of this thing. I'm interested in the user model aspects. So I think it's clear that there's ways to implement the isolation pretty well. Yes?
So the question is whether those two aspects are at loggerheads with each other. In order to have good user experience, you need to be able to share stuff you care about between the two.
That's critical, and I'm going to talk about that, but I'm not going to talk about the technology of isolation.
Okay.
Yes, but that's very critical. That's the most critical thing, in fact.
Right. And I guess the meta point is that isolation is great as long as it's strict. As soon as you start compromising
then
sharing...
Then it gets more fragile. Right. That's why we need accountability.
Are you going to say
something? These things go hand in hand, in my view. The whole idea of green doesn't make any sense without accountability.
Okay.
On the other hand, accountability doesn't make any sense without red and green because it's too restrictive. So that's the reason that this talk has these two apparently unrelated things in it.
Are you going to say something besides what's green?
Yes. The basic answer is going to be you decide, because all trust is local. But that clearly isn't good enough, and I'm going to say more about that.
Question from San Diego, Butler.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if the trend towards service-oriented or online deployment of applications makes it harder to have a trust-as-local model, right? If everything's on my machine, fine. But if the application is half provided by Microsoft and half by Google and half by somebody else, life gets a little more challenging, it seems.
Well, I don't think I want an application that's provided half by Microsoft and half by Google and half by somebody else. For one thing, too many halves. For another thing, that's too complicated. It's not going to work anyway. But I have to decide whether I'm going to trust Microsoft to provide the service. Absolutely.
Wasn't that basically IE with the Google toolbar? You've already got that.
Yeah, and I don't like it.
But it doesn't work very well.
That's been my experience.
Not only do I need to trust Microsoft, but presumably one of the advantages of doing this is now I can move around and use it a lot of different places. So now I have to trust Microsoft and the purveyor of my local cycles, which may now...
This is one of the reasons why I don't really believe in this purveyor of local cycles story, and I don't want to go into that. but I'll just tell you that I don't believe in it. I have a lot of reasons why I don't believe in it, and that's one of them. But we don't have time to discuss that. Okay, so how to think about red-green? Here's a way to think about it. Today I've got a computer. It talks to accountable places, which are still going to generate some attacks, but not too many, small m. And it talks to unaccountable places, which are going to generate lots of attacks, as we've heard from Steve and Auk, big m. And they all pile into my computer, and everything's mixed up in there, and that's obviously bad. And the obvious way to fix that is to divide my computer into two parts. There's the red computer, which has the less valuable stuff in it. It gets the big m attacks. And when you run into trouble, you blow it away. The green side, I have the valuable stuff. It gets many fewer attacks, so I'm way ahead of where I am now. Of course, it's not going to be perfect. We're not striving for perfection. The best is the enemy of the good. Security is about risk management. So don't tell me that it's not going to be perfect, because I already know that. An essential, critical aspect of this red-green story is you got to get the configuration right. You got to keep the valuable green stuff out of red. This picture is bad. Right? And you have to keep the hostile guys out of green. This is bad, too. So how are we going to do that? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. So here's another version of the story about why do we want red-green. The basic problem is any realistic operating system is going to be exploitable. The richer it is, the more bugs there are going to be. The systems keep getting richer and richer. Furthermore, we need internet access to get work done and to have fun, and the internet is full of bad guys. So the solution is going to be isolated environments. In green, we put the important assets. We only talk to the good guys. We don't tickle the bugs. In red, we live wild and free. We put less important stuff. We talk to anybody. And if we run into trouble, we just reset. And what it means to be a good guy is that you're more accountable, and what it means to be a bad guy is that you're less accountable. So how are we going to configure green? Well, green means locked down. Oh, by the way, some people say, well, gosh, right now I have a green machine. You're proposing to have red. That's completely untrue. Right now you have a red machine. I'm going to give you green. Okay, so you're going to be much better off. Because there's going to be at least some place to stand where you're going to be reasonably safe. Very few people have green machines today. Yes?
So I use a different definition of good right now, and that's how much stake that site has in being good. You know, if I go to CNN, they've got a huge...
That's exactly an aspect of accountability. They have something at stake. You're absolutely right. That, and what it means to have something at stake is you can be punished. You've got something to lose. Absolutely. I agree with you completely. So what it means to be green is to be locked down. It means only whitelist inputs. It does not mean any input that doesn't have a bad signature. It means only whitelist inputs, damn it. Because blacklist is not a way to get accountability. One implication of that is that green machines are going to have professional management for the most part. You know, Steve and Auk can manage their own green machines, but normal people can't. Dialog box has popped up. The normal person says, okay, right? That's not any good for green machines. And to escape from the straitjacket of a lockdown machine, you know, today people don't like lockdown machines because there's a lot of things you can't do. That's not a problem in my golden world of the future because you can do anything you want in the red machine, okay? So everybody can be happy, including the corporate IT department. They're going to be absolutely blissful because they can stop having all these arguments with the users about what should be allowed. Okay, but there's a problem, which Steve pointed out 10 minutes ago. People don't want complete isolation, right? They want to move stuff from red to green. They want to cut and paste, drag and drop, share parts of the file system, share the screen, administer only one machine, not two. But, of course, more integration weakens isolation. It adds bugs, compromises security. It's bad. What are we going to do about it? Well, there's not going to be a perfect solution, right? The best is the enemy of the good. We're just going to do the best we can. So let's think about it. Data transfer, I think.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt. Do you think that in the future you could actually make it so instead of sharing screens, average users don't even know which machine they happen to be on, but you can sort of direct them to the right?
This is what the Microsoft senior management would like. Microsoft senior management does not like the red-green story because they say it's going to wreck the user experience. You're going to be in your face. You're going to be in the user's face. They're going to hate it. I think two things. First of all, I absolutely don't believe that what you said is possible, that it's going to be transparent, that the user doesn't have to know. Furthermore, I don't think it's going to wreck the user experience at all. I think it's going to improve it dramatically because the user's going to know where they are.
It's not like it's your shit grade today, right?
Right. So I absolutely don't think that what you propose is possible, and I also don't think it's a problem. But I do have to say that my management does not like red-green, and that's why they don't like it. The other reason they don't like it, I think, is they don't want to admit defeat. They believe that they can get all the security bugs out of the 50 million lines of code. I mean, if you ask them up front, they won't say that. But deep in their hearts, I think that's what they believe.
I have a question.
It doesn't make any sense. You're absolutely right. But what can I say?
I have a question.
Yes.
So the next generation browser is going to operate within a shell which can't affect the operating system as a whole. It has a very limited permissions.
That's the theory.
Isn't this an example of the red-green that you're talking
well,
about?
Well, yeah, my personal... Maybe it'll work. My personal opinion is that it's not going to be nearly hard-nosed enough. But I could be wrong. Maybe low-rights IE is going to work. I'm skeptical. I think that life is too complex. That's why I like the virtual machine isolation story, because the interface is a lot simpler. But I'm open-minded, and I'm not going to talk about isolation technology. Okay, so what are the problems with data transfer? Somehow we have to mediate data transfer between the machines, drag and drop, cut and paste, shared folders, all those things. What do we have to worry about? Well, red to green, the obvious problem is malware gets in. Green to red, the obvious problem is information leaks out. Both of those things are bad. So you're going to have policy to control this. What policies are possible? Well, you could make rules about what types of data it's okay to transfer. You know, vanilla ASCII is probably okay. We won't worry about that too much. Another possibility is you could say we're not going to ever transfer data except after non-spoofable user interaction. Another possibility is you can have various forms of auditing where as the data gets transferred, it gets looked at in various ways. I don't know. There's obviously no perfect solution for this problem. We'll just do the best we can. The most painful aspect of data transfer, I think, is applications like email and instant messaging. Where should they run? Well, these are productivity applications, so that means they have to be well integrated into the work environment. At least that's the story that sells $15 billion a year of Microsoft Office. But the threat, obviously, is these things are a tunnel to the bad guys. You have executable attachments. You have exploits of complicated data formats. You have all kinds of crap. So what are the choices? Well, I see several possibilities. One straightforward possibility, the hard-nosed one, is you run two copies. You run a green email client and IM client and a red email client and IM client, and they run in the separate worlds. And users aren't going to like this at all because now they have to look at two different inboxes on two different screens, and that's going to be a real pain. And maybe you could have some notification stuff so Toast pops up and things, but it's not going to be good. Another possibility is you could run in green, and you could mitigate the threats by saying the green platform certainly isn't going to run arbitrary programs, and more than that, it's going to be very conservative in the file formats that appear. If it sees HTML the least bit suspicious, it's going to insist on running it in red. That might be okay. You could try routing messages to the appropriate machine, you know, having one email server, but routing the messages to the appropriate machine based on some judgment that you make. I don't know. This is an unsolved problem. It's clear there are possible ways to do it, but they're kind of clunky. We'd like to have something that's not too clunky. My own money would be on the second thing here, running green and mitigate the threats, but I'm not sure. Last slide, last content slide. What about networking? The story of red and green machine, almost certainly is going to go with it in real life, is red and green networking. So let's see how that might work, at least in the enterprise environment. Pretty much we have this in the enterprise today in a limited way. There's going to be a green enterprise network, which is going to be defined by IPsec, firewalls, proxy settings, and all that other rigmarole, which is going to allow the green machines to talk to the green servers, and also to some limited green servers that are inside, and also to some limited approved set of green websites. And then there's going to be the red network, which is going to let you talk to the whole internet, but only from your red machine. And an interesting observation is that this is going to have to be enforced by routing somewhere. Typically, people try to enforce this kind of network isolation by putting stuff in routers or firewalls or whatever you want to call them. But if you have virtual machines, one option is if you make all the network traffic flow through a well-secured VM on your desktop machine, then you can put the router there and you can take that functionality over from Cisco and control it much better. And that seems appealing. Okay, so let's summarize all of this. Security is about risk management. The basic game is you got to make the cost of security less than the expected loss. Otherwise, people are not going to do it. Security relies on deterrence. That means you have to have punishment. That means you have to have accountability. If you're going to have accountability, you have to have an ecosystem. Senders have to be able to become accountable. Receivers have to be able to verify accountability. And it has to be convenient. Accountability is bad because it limits freedom. So we fix that by having a red world and a green world. The green world is accountable. The red world is free. In the green world, we don't tickle the bugs. In the red world, we blow it away when we run into trouble. And that's the end of the story. Thank you. I just thought this started out as a one-hour talk originally. It's been condensed to half an hour.
Okay, that leaves us 30 seconds for questions. Anybody else here?
Evelyn, do you have a prototype in your office yet?
No. We have some baby steps towards a prototype inside of Microsoft, but it's not very deployable yet.
There are two machines, they just don't talk to each other.
Well, no, that doesn't count. You've got to solve that data transfer problem. Otherwise, it's no good.
Well, we have red green in our house. A lot of people probably do this. The red mm-hmm. are called kids' computers, mm-hmm. and the green are called adult computers.
That helps.
It's the only way, keeping the kids off the adult computers is the only way to do it.
So one thing I was wondering here is, would you characterize this as being similar to the distinction in like Unix, where you have the root user who owns all of the base operating system stuff, ordinary users who can't change any of that?
No, I wouldn't at all, because what happens in real life in Unix is that the stuff I care about is stuff that I own as an ordinary user, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one.
So that's completely useless.
My next point, yes.
That's completely. No, the green machine is not the same thing as the OS kernel or the super user or anything like that. The green machine is the stuff I care about.
Okay.
But the green machine, the green machine is a full functional machine. Okay, it's not restricted in any way, except by the inputs that you allow into it. You can run any piece of software on it that you're willing to, that you consider sufficiently accountable. And I think that's really critical. Otherwise, the whole thing isn't going to work at all.
What is your vision as far as users verifying accountability? I
mean, my vision is that for the most part, that's going to be done by some pro. I'm going to contract with Microsoft OneCare or Symantec, currently non-existent, but I'm sure coming in the future, or my corporate IT department is going to manage my green machine. And they're going to decide what software is okay and what probably fairly large set of websites is potentially okay. I mean, they'll find out the websites of the 3,000 of all the nationally chartered banks, and then I can pick the ones that I actually care about and so forth. But it's got to be professional management because the decisions are too hard for people, ordinary people.
So an extreme version of Microsoft services push means that there will be no software on your box. It will all be remote.
I assure you we don't want that. And I absolutely don't believe in that for numerous reasons. Thin clients? Yeah.
Do you want to say a few more words about that?
What, about why thin clients are no good? Well, several reasons. One is it's not going to be reliable enough. It is possible to configure a server-based computing environment that is reliable enough, but it's hard. Very few people do it. Okay? And especially as the thing gets richer, it gets harder. I don't think it's going to happen. It's too expensive. There's lots of other drawbacks to doing things on server. I mean, I'm all in favor of synchronization. I'm all in favor of Google. I believe in centralization. I don't believe in distributed computing either. Okay, I don't believe in least privilege. I don't believe in distributed computing. I definitely for centralization. I don't believe in thin clients. I'm totally heretical. I invented quite a few of these things, right? I give another talk about things that have worked and things that haven't in the world of computer systems, and quite a few of the things that haven't worked are things that I worked on. So I feel that I can speak with passion and authority. I think thin clients could be okay for very narrowly defined things, but if you look at the economics of what cycles cost, what bandwidth cost, how hard it is to get reliability, all the cases where you can't really count on connectivity, I really just don't see that it makes any sense. And the reason people are hot for thin clients is because we, Microsoft, have done such a crappy job of making it impossible for you to manage your PC. And we are gradually, slowly, agonizingly, painfully making it better. And in a few more years, it will be kind of reasonable, and this whole thin client thing will just go away completely. Because the only reason people want thin clients is because it's too much of a pain to manage your PC. And there is no law of nature that says that has to be true. It's just that we have butchered it. You want to know why we butchered it? It's really simple. People who work for Microsoft like to fuss with their PCs. It's fun. And they cannot imagine anyone who wouldn't want to fuss with their PC. Again, you know, intellectually they know that that's wrong, but emotionally when they have to decide what to do when faced with a hard decision, the manageability is not important because fussing is fun. This is my theory. I mean, obviously you can't prove this. I mean, it's the same thing with Unix. When I left Xerox and went to work for DEC in 1984, I had to learn to use Unix, and I hated it. And it took me about 6 months to figure out what the problem was. And the problem was, in order to be a successful user of Unix, you have to be always programming. Now, there are different kinds of people. There are some people who like to always program. You know, code just drips from their fingers. Well, I like to think carefully when I program. For daily stuff, I like to just push buttons. So I am not a good Unix user. It's just the way it is. Other questions? Okay?
Thank you very much. Okay, guys, see you next week.